Thank you, Larry, and thank you to our worship team this morning. When I heard that Pastor Bill and Pastor Steve were both going to be on vacation the same Sunday, I was initially a little bit nervous about that, but we've got so many great people that are filling in for things and taking care of everything today that it's really been no problem at all. I want to thank Tammy for leading the worship team this morning and Dr. McGrew for being here for Sunday school. It's been a great morning so far, and so I'm excited to continue that with a sermon this morning. When I was in middle school, my brother and sister both moved to Grand Rapids to a duplex together. And one of the first weekends that they were living up there, the rest of our family decided to take a trip to go and visit them, and we were going to have a cookout that afternoon, and so my dad was the designated grill master. And I was outside with him and helping get things ready, and as we were waiting for the grill to warm up or the food to cook, I can't remember which, we were just looking for some things to do, and so we were pulling weeds along the driveway, and my dad noticed a little maple tree growing up in the cracks between parts of the sidewalk or the driveway, and so we went and grabbed it and pulled it up, and to both of our surprise, the entire thing came out, roots and all. And so we were surprised, we were impressed by the resilience of this little tree, and so we decided it deserved better than just to be tossed aside and thrown in the garbage, and so we decided to get it back in some soil and take it home and plant it and see what would happen. And so that little tree managed to survive the rest of that afternoon out in the sun and survive the drive home. We planted it, and over that summer, it was making it. We went out just about every day, and we watered it, and we watched it grow, and it was doing great. And then all of a sudden, one day in the fall, we go out to water the tree, and it was almost gone. There was just a tiny little chewed-off stump, and it looked like a deer had come along and said, "Looks like a good snack," and decided to eat the tree. And so, you know, winter came, we forgot about it. It was disappointing, it was a little sad, but, you know, it's just a tree. But then we came back in the spring, and there was a little bit of growth on it. And we thought, hey, this thing's not dead after all. Let's see what happens. And so we went back to watering it, and we put some stakes around it to make sure we wouldn't mow over it. And we were taking care of it again all summer long and watching it grow and watching more and more leaves come out. It might have been later that year or the next year, tragedy strikes again. We come outside, and there's a little chewed-off stump again. And so this time we learned our lesson. We thought we know this thing might be able to make it back, and so we gave it a little more time. Sure enough, it starts to grow back again, and this time we thought we need to defend this. And so we dug it up. We moved it to a different location where it would be safer. We put a little temporary fence around it, and once again, that tree came back, and it started to grow and grow and grow, and eventually it's become this. I don't know exactly how tall it is. I don't know, maybe 15, 20 feet tall. It made it. It grew. It's not a full-size maple tree yet, but there it is. It's alive. I think it's going to be with us for a while. This tree can teach us a thing or two about thriving, about overcoming adversity. I think as Christians, we can be fragile sometimes. When everything is going well, our faith feels really strong. We come to church, we praise Jesus, we worship him, everything seems like it's going great, nothing is going to stand in our way. But then a little rough patch shows up, we start to fall apart. We whine, we complain, we cry out to God, why me, why is this happening? And a lot of times, it's really over nothing, if you think about it. Now at the same time, we see a lot of other Christians that face obstacles and hardships head on. We see other Christians whose faith remains intact despite going through job loss or financial trouble or health issues or just loss of any other kind. We see Christians who endure persecution. Around the world, we see Christians who face their tormentors head on with absolute fearlessness. When we have Jesus on our side thriving, even in the face of hardships and opposition, it should be easy. And for a lot of Christians, we see it looks like it is. But then there's other times we struggle with that, right? There's other times where we know we need to improve, but we wonder, how can I? Why don't I seem to have what it takes to get through this struggle? And so for the next 3 weeks, we're going to be turning to the book of Philippians to find out. I wish I had time to preach through the entire book, but we're just going to get three select passages out of it. And today we're going to be in chapter 1, starting in verse 27. So if you'd like to follow along, go ahead and turn there. But while you're doing that, let me give you a little context. Philippians is a letter that was written by Paul to the church at the city of Philippi. back in the earliest days of the church. Now, the key theme of this book specifically is having joy, specifically joy no matter what circumstances you face, because we have Christ. Paul says that if you have Jesus, that should be enough. And we know that this is not just empty talk by Paul, because he lived this message. When Paul wrote this letter, he was sitting in a jail cell. He was in prison for spreading the message of Jesus. And yet, even though he was no stranger to suffering, he's able to sit there and say, have joy because of Christ. Have joy because of your faith. And he wrote this letter in hopes that his readers would learn how to do the same thing. Okay, so who are his readers? Who are the Philippians? Well, Philippi was a coastal town on the northern shore of the Aegean Sea. It's in an area, it's in what we would consider Greece today. Back then it was called Macedonia. And at that time it was under total Roman control. In fact, most of the people living in Philippi at this time would have been Roman citizens and would have been very proud of that, actually. You can read about the history of this church if you go to Acts chapter 16, which Pastor Steve preached on just a couple of weeks ago. Paul and his companions go to Philippi and they meet a woman named Lydia and they lead her to Christ. A couple things happen and they get thrown in jail. And then they lead the jailer to Christ. They get out of jail and they go and they meet with this church and they encourage this church to grow. And then they're on their way. And we don't read about this city again until a brief mention in Acts chapter 20. And then it's nothing until we get all the way to this book, Philippians, where we might not learn exactly what happened between those points to this church, but we do know because of this letter that the church made it. We know that it seemed like it was growing. We'd learn that the faith of these Christians was encouraging to Paul. They were concerned for him. They prayed for him. They contributed financially to his ministry. And we learn that Paul had developed a strong love for these people because of their faith. And so he wanted to be able to go back and visit them, but because of being in a prison cell, he was unable to. So he begins the letter by encouraging these people to continue having joy because of Jesus. He's encouraging them that no matter what they have to suffer, no matter what they go through, in fact, whether they live or die, they're secure forever because of Jesus. That's something to be excited about. So that brings us up to our text for today. We're going to start with Philippians 1, 27 through 30, where Paul writes, "Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel, and not frightened in anything by your opponents. This is a clear sign to them of their destruction, but of your salvation, and that from God. For it has been granted to you that for the sake of Christ, you should not only believe in him, but also suffer for his sake, engaged in the same conflict that you saw I had, and now hear that I still have." So let's hone in on this first word, only. This lets us know that we're transitioning from one thought to another. So we have to go back for a second and see what came before this. And in the verses leading up to this section, Paul was wrestling with a little dilemma. Again, he was in prison when he wrote this letter. And so one of two things was going to happen. On one hand, he might be getting out of prison. He might have the opportunity to go back out into the world and preach the gospel and spread the message of Jesus, and even go back to this church in Philippi and see these Christians and get to be encouraged by them again. Or, on the other hand, he might die in prison. And so here's the dilemma. Which one of those things should he want to have happen? What should he be hoping for? What should he be praying for? I think if you put most of us in that situation, we would say, well, obviously, I don't want to die. Let's pray that I get out of prison. But let's hold on a second. Yes, being released from jail would be a great thing. It would mean freedom. It would mean visiting all of these churches that Paul had planted. It would mean sharing the gospel. And it would mean the obvious, not having to die, especially not having to die soon and at the hands of a Roman executioner. Seems like a good option to me. But death, for the follower of Jesus, that's not the worst thing that could happen. For a Christian, death means being with Jesus. And so in this situation, whether he lived or died, Paul says this is a win. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm the kind of person who likes winning. Anybody with me? I do agree with the phrase, it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. But I also like that quote by Vince Lombardi, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing, right? I like to win. If I'm going to play a game, it's fun to win, right? Now, I know that I don't always have to win, and I know that you can't always win. It's just that it's nice when it happens. And so if I'm in a competition, I want to make sure that happens as often as I can possibly make it happen. And if you don't believe me, let's look for proof. Go visit the youth group some night when we're playing dodgeball. I'll just leave it at that. I suspect I'm not the only one who feels that way, right? We like to win. And so with that being said, this is one of the things I love. We should all love about the Christian faith. With Jesus, no matter what happens, we win. Things are going well, obviously that's a win. But even when things aren't going well, even if we face death, we win because we have Jesus. No matter what, Christians can have joy. Not just can have joy, Christians ought to have joy. There should be zero grouchy Christians. Go ahead, smile, laugh. It's all right because you have Jesus. You're winning. And that brings us to this word only. We are only going to benefit from that win. We're only going to experience that joy with one condition. As he goes on to say, we have to live a life worthy of the gospel. In other words, we have to live like the faith that we claim we have is actually real. We have to live like we actually believe the things that we say we believe. That's a hard one, isn't it? That phrase, let your manner of life, literally translates to live as a citizen. So, a citizen of where? Heaven, right? When somebody moves into a neighborhood, not just from another neighborhood, but from another part of the world, it's usually obvious, right? Because they carry the marks with them of their former culture. They've left another place behind, and usually you can see that maybe in the way that they dress, or in the way that they speak, or in just the customs that they observe, the way that they carry themselves. They don't know yet the new customs of the new location, and so, of course, they're going to do things a little bit differently. And sometimes the locals, whether they say it or just think it, might have that phrase, you're not from around here, are you, on their minds. As human beings, we were specifically designed to live on earth. But as Christians, our citizenship is of a nation that is not of this world. We're citizens of heaven. We're waiting for the day when heaven and earth are one, as Christ intended for it to be. But in the meantime, right now, it's our job to represent Jesus, represent his kingdom here on earth. And that means that we ought to act like it. And if we did act like it, there should be a lot of people around the world looking at us going, these people aren't from around here, are they? So what does that look like to live this otherworldly sort of life that proves to everybody around us that we believe what we say we believe? Well, Paul gives us two characteristics. First of all, we stand firm in one spirit with one mind. And two, we strive side by side for the faith of the gospel. So let's look at these a little bit more closely. First of all, stand firm in one spirit with one mind. This is the foundational aspect of our life. What do you base your life on? How do you determine how you will live? How you will act? What are you standing on? You might call this your worldview. You could stand on culture. You could stand on your wealth or your accomplishments. You could just stand on your own good ideas from one minute to the next. And a lot of people do that, any one of those things. And a lot of times that works out pretty well, at least for a while. But as Christians, we are instructed that our foundation must be the gospel. It must be faith in the fact that Jesus died for us horribly on a cross so that he could bring us back to God so we could have a relationship again with God as we were meant to from the beginning. And if we're trying to live in a way that is worthy of the gospel, then it should go without saying that we're standing on that gospel, right? That we stand on, we're rooted on that truth. But I think in this passage in particular, what we're standing on isn't necessarily what Paul's going after. That should go without saying. I think he seems to be a lot more concerned with who we are standing with. He says, stand firm in one spirit with one mind. The church is made up of thousands, maybe millions, of distinct individual people, unique people. And yet, we're supposed to come together as one, as if we were one person. We need to be in agreement about the things that matter. We need to move forward with one singular force or purpose, as if though many, again, we are one person. The text here translates this literally as one man. When Jennifer and I moved into our house, there was this plant, this bush-like vine, I'm not sure exactly how to describe it, that was growing on our back fence. I'm sure it could be beautiful if treated properly, but ours had been allowed to grow out of control, and it was starting to damage the fence, and so we decided, let's just cut this thing down. And so I went out to the fence one day, I cut it off, I dug out the roots a little bit, got rid of the thing. But then a few weeks later, a vine sprouts up out of the ground again, and it starts to grow up the fence again. And so I cut it down a second time. And by the way, I do understand the irony here between this story and the previous one. Sometimes resilience is an endearing trait, and sometimes it makes you angry, right? But this vine kept coming back, and we kept having to cut it out. And so finally, after a few cycles of this, I decided I'm going to really get at this thing. And I dug down deep into the ground to try to get the roots out. And that's when I realized that the roots of this vine, which, by the way, were not just growing up on the fence, but they were starting to pop up all over the yard. And that's when I realized that this is all one plant. The roots are traveling all over our yard. They're going into our garden. They're going into all sorts of spots along our fence. And we can't get rid of this thing because it's rooted too deep. And whenever we would cut it off in one place, it would grow up in another. And so every spring and summer to this day, we have to cut out pieces of this vine that grow up in our garden or on our fence or wherever because it's just too tough to deal with, right? It's down in too deep. It's too rooted. It's one plant that won't stop coming back. It's the vine that won't die. And I think that Christians ought to be a little bit more like that vine. If we're all rooted in the same source, Jesus, then even though we are individual, distinct, unique people, we're really all just one. And because of that, we ought to be tough to deal with. Now, the second characteristic that Paul gives us of a life worthy of the gospel is that we strive side by side for the faith of the gospel. Strive is actually an athletic term. So an over-competitive guy like myself can relate to this one. The Greeks were known for, among other things, their athletic contests. They're the ones that gave us the Olympic Games to begin with. And so for the Philippians to read this word strive, or in the Greek it was synthaleo, I messed that up, I'm sorry. This would have invoked images of an athlete fighting on, pressing toward a goal, trying to win. And Paul says that this is something we do side by side. We don't do this alone. It's a team sport. Our team has been given an objective. We have one singular act that together we must somehow accomplish. So what's the objective? What are we fighting for? The faith of the gospel. The gospel, the good news that God loves us enough to send Jesus to rescue us from our sin and from our impending physical and spiritual death. This is a beautiful thing. This is a precious thing to us. And it's something that we shouldn't be able to keep to ourselves. This is news that we're supposed to share, that we should feel compelled to share, so that everyone ultimately knows this truth. So now let's put these two things together. First of all, we're rooted in the gospel together with other Christians. And second, we fight for the gospel together with other Christians. So what's the common theme running through both of these? Togetherness. Unity. The Christian faith is meant to be lived in community. It can't possibly be lived out by yourself. We thrive in Christ when we stand united. Now, don't get me wrong, the decision to become a Christian is an individual choice. Nobody can make you be a believer in Jesus. And the responsibility you have as a Christian to obey Jesus, to follow him, that's a personal responsibility as well. Nobody can make you be a Christian and act as you are supposed to act as a Christian. But when you make this choice to follow Jesus, to commit your life to him, to grow in him, that's not something that you can do alone. By necessity, this choice puts you in a community with other Christians. It's impossible to live an authentic Christian faith without finding yourself in community. It simply cannot be done alone. Yet it's amazing to me how many Christians try to do it alone. I mean, the truth is that that's actually a very American idea, rugged individualism, right? I can do it all by myself. But it's not a very Christian idea. Jesus doesn't want you to do this alone. He doesn't want you to learn alone. He doesn't want you to serve alone. This one's tough, but when we sin, he doesn't want you to deal with that alone. We're made for community. We need to embrace that. And when we do embrace that, then another characteristic develops as we move on to verses 28 through 30. And not frightened in anything by your opponents, this is a clear sign to them of their destruction, but of your salvation, and that from God. For it has been granted to you that for the sake of Christ you should not only believe in him, but also suffer for his sake, engaged in the same conflict that you saw I had, and now hear that I still have. Okay, so let's face it. It's a scary world out there, right? We read the news, we watch TV, we realize that our country is becoming less and less Christian every single day, right? We live in a culture that not only enjoys sin, but embraces it, glorifies it, celebrates it, right? And because of that, it seems like it's getting harder and harder and harder to live an authentic Christian life in the world that we live in. Now, I'm not one to quickly jump to the conclusion that we are under serious persecution. I don't like to use that word lightly, because when you look at other Christians around the world, when you look at other Christians throughout history that have had to endure death and violence and all sorts of other things, we don't have the first clue what real persecution is like, not yet. We're still free to gather in a place like this. We can still talk about our faith in most settings, and not have to worry about going to jail. We aren't yet at the point where we're seeing Christians in our country, in our city, being beaten and killed because of their faith on a daily basis, even though that is happening in other parts of the world and has happened throughout history. We're not facing real persecution in that sense, at least not yet, but we still have opponents, right? And our opponents can be intimidating, can't they? The opposition must have been, if it's frightening to us, it must have been terrifying in Paul's day. I mean, back then, Christianity was just starting. The numbers were growing, but it was still a small minority. Today, we take for granted that people know what we're talking about when we use the term Christian. They have some idea of what we believe or what we're about. In Paul's day, and with the Philippians, they didn't have that luxury. The majority would have seen them as odd at best, but at worst, they would have been seen as disloyal, bad citizens, dangerous, right? And in the face of that opposition, Paul is telling the Philippians, those guys out there, they ought to be afraid of us. They ought to be intimidated by us if we stand united. If we go it alone, we're going to get chewed up and spit out by the world faster than we can think. But if we stand united, our faith will thrive. And it's the world who will look at us and be intimidated. Now, the church has always faced opposition. Over the last 2,000 years, there have been all sorts of adversaries to come up against the church, and yet it has never been destroyed. In fact, in many places today, the church is still heavily persecuted, and yet in a lot of those places, the church is growing. In the early days, the church survived the Pharisees, survived pagan religions, the Roman Empire. All throughout history, the church has survived different heresies, opposing political ideas, violent enemies at times, cultural clashes that at some times were a lot more hostile than others. You name it, the church has endured it, right? The church has never been destroyed. I fully believe that no outside force is ever going to destroy the church, as intimidating as it may seem, because Jesus told us in Matthew 16:18, and I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Nothing outside of the church, not even Satan himself, is ever going to stop the church. I was going over my sermon yesterday with Jen, and I got to this point, and I hear Jack very passionately go, "Don't stop the church." Don't worry, Jack, nothing outside of the church is going to stop the church. But there is another threat that we face that could do some real serious damage to the church. And that's not a threat from outside, it's a threat from within. By failing to stand united in the gospel, for the gospel, we do more damage to the church than any outside force ever possibly could. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that we can thwart the plans of God. Even when we fail, God still manages to win. That's the beauty, the glory of the God that we serve. But by fighting amongst ourselves, by not looking out for each other, by not taking care of each other, by failing to work together to serve other people, we seriously undermine our effectiveness, especially our effectiveness at sharing the gospel with the rest of the world. I couldn't find the origin of it, but one of my professors in seminary used this quote a couple of times: "The only army that shoots its wounded is the Christian army." Obviously, that's not 100% true, and I don't think it's necessarily meant to be. I think it's all too common in any human setting to kick people when they're down, right? Whether it's work or sports or fun or whatever, we have a tendency to do that, unfortunately, as human beings. I think the reason for this quote, though, is because it expresses the hypocrisy of this in the context of Christianity. We, of all people, should understand grace and humility and mercy. We expect the world to act this way, to kick each other when they're down, but of all places, the church should be one where we lift each other up when we're down, right? We have experienced the unfathomable mercy and grace of our loving God, and we of all people should understand how and why we need to show that to others. But instead, I think there's a perception a lot of times among Christians that we're supposed to have it all together. So we might say things like, "I'm not perfect, I'm just forgiven." Who's heard that before? Right? And it's true. But at the same time, we're afraid to admit our faults. We're afraid to talk about our sins, our struggles. As much as we like to talk about and point out the brokenness of the world, we don't like to talk about it in ourselves. And we have an image to maintain, right? And in an effort to maintain that image, it's all too easy to make other people the scapegoat, right? And so we highlight other people's sins, or again, we kick other people, other Christians, when they're down, because it draws the attention off ourselves. It's just my theory, at least. Or how about this? Instead of actually putting our faith into action, serving with each other, helping the world, it's a lot easier to just talk about issues, to squabble about things, usually things that don't matter all that much, minor theological differences, disagreements about how or why we do certain things in the church. It's a lot easier to go down those roads than it is to actually have to put all that stuff into action. And so there's a flawed line of thinking a lot of times among us as Christians that the idea of being mature in our faith means that we have it all figured out. We know all the right information. We do everything the right way. But what's God's definition? This is just a piece of it. But religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world. James 1:27. Real faith has to go beyond information. It needs action. I believe that if together we were to focus on action and if we were to put our faith to use by serving each other and by serving people outside of the church, by sharing the gospel, rather than only being concerned with knowing all of the right facts or doing everything the right way, then I think we would have as what Paul describes here. We would be a church that has no reason to be afraid of the world. But instead, by our actions, we would serve as a reminder to the outside world that because of Jesus, their way of thinking, it can't sustain them. That's not the way of life. Jesus is the only path to life. Now, don't get me wrong, that doesn't mean that they're automatically going to become Christians if we do that. There's no magic bullet for that. There's still going to be opposition. In fact, in some cases, that's going to ramp up the opposition if we're living out our faith authentically. But if nothing else, we're going to be reminding people about Jesus. And we're going to be reminding ourselves, we've already won. There's nothing to be afraid of. So this should motivate us to endure through those struggles. It should motivate us to keep on sharing the gospel, telling people outside the church about Jesus so that they can experience that life-changing power that he gives to us. Now, in the next few verses, Paul's going to describe what this kind of faith looks like. But before we get there, I want to skip ahead to chapter 4. And I want to look at what happens when we don't live out our faith this way. Let's look at chapter 4, verses 2 and 3. Paul writes, "I entreat Euodia and I entreat Syntyche to agree in the Lord. Yes, I ask you also, true companion, help these women who have labored side by side with me in the gospel, together with Clement and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life." So, in these verses, Paul is calling out two women, Euodia and Syntyche. He's calling them out by name for having some sort of disagreement or dispute with each other. Now, who were these women? Well, unfortunately, we don't know, because this is the only place where they're ever mentioned in the Bible. All we know is that they're Christians who had worked with Paul at some point in the past. I mean, maybe they were some of the earliest believers when Paul started the church in Acts 16. Maybe they were some people who came along later. Maybe they were even from another city and they came to help the early church get going there. Whoever they were, all we can do is guess. They had some sort of disagreement with each other that was obviously bad enough that Paul had to call them out for it, not only in front of the entire church at Philippi, but in front of all churches across history, because this made it in the Bible. We also don't know what the disagreement was about. My guess, though, is it was probably something really petty. Here's my reasoning here. I have to think that if this was a really weighty theological issue that the two of them were disputing over, Paul probably would have weighed in as far as who was right. If it was that significant that a winner needed to be declared in the argument, I feel like Paul would have weighed in. But instead, he just says, just agree. However you have to do it. Meet in the middle somewhere. One of you just is humble and says the other one's right. Come up with something. Just agree. So that leads me to think that whatever the situation was they were fighting over didn't even matter. It was meaningless. It was pointless. It was petty. And for that, they wind up as little more than a warning sign to the rest of us for all of eternity, essentially. And can you imagine that happening to you? Can you imagine being mentioned in the Bible because you had some little feud going on with another Christian and neither of you could manage to resolve it? And so Paul has to call you out in the most permanent way possible. And now you go down in history as that lady, as that guy who couldn't get along with other Christians. And talk about embarrassing, right? Any of you in school ever get called out in front of the whole class by your teacher? That was the worst, right? I hated that. And it happened a few times. And as bad as that is to get called out in front of 20 or 30 other kids in elementary school, imagine being called out in front of all Christians across time in the Bible. But that's the thing is, I mean, what makes us think that our squabbles, our petty little disputes, are any less embarrassing to the church? I mean, they don't get written down in the Bible, thankfully. That's one reason we can be glad that the book is done being written. We can't make it in there as a bad example. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that we're any less of a stain on the church in the eyes of the non-believing world when they see us going at each other's throats for pointless stuff, right? We have to be better than that. That's why we have this example in the first place, so that we won't be like that. And if you really think about it too, do you know what should be especially concerning about these two women? Is that it looks like Euodia and Syntyche were not just some phony Christians. They weren't even brand new, immature Christians. Look at the ways that Paul describes them. First of all, their names are written in the book of life. So they are Christians. And then he goes on to say that they had worked with him, they'd labored with him in the gospel. So it sounds like these are some women who had put some work in, they'd put effort in. They might have even been leaders in the church for all we know. If it hadn't been for this dispute, who knows, Paul might have gone on later in the book to thank them as he did a lot of other people in most of his letters. And yet, despite that, they were not immune from having this disagreement come up that threatened to unravel everything they had worked for. And I think that should make us pause. If they weren't immune to it, are any of us immune to it? Do you want to grow and thrive as a Christian? Do you want to use your gifts to serve the church, to reach the world around you, to make an impact on your family, on your community, on the whole world for Jesus? And not only that, do you want to keep on doing that? Do you want to make sure that you don't reach some point in your life where you give up, where you stop, where you slip up and you just never get back to where you were again? Well, if you want to do that, you can't do it alone. You definitely can't do it if you're in the middle of some pointless, petty feud with another Christian. The only way we're going to become effective as Christians and then keep on being effective throughout our lives is if we stand united. We have to be grounded in the same faith and work side by side toward the same goal of seeing that faith reach the world. So how do we do that? Well, let's take a look at the first few verses of chapter 2. So if there is any encouragement in Christ, any comfort from love, any participation in the Spirit, any affection and sympathy, complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look out not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus. Standing united is actually pretty simple if you think about it. It's one of those things that the concept is simple, pulling it off is the hard part. First of all, it means we agree with each other. At least we agree with the stuff that really matters. And then agreeing to not let the other stuff get in the way. And trust me, I know how hard that can be, to not say something when you feel within your bones you feel like somebody else is wrong. And you want to say something. But you know that saying something is going to do more harm to the relationship than it's going to do good. Are you with me? And it's especially hard in this age of social media where all you have to do is type a comment and walk away and you don't have to see the other person face to face. But again, is it worth potentially damaging a relationship with another Christian just to prove that you're right over something that probably doesn't matter? I've heard the piece of advice before that before you state a fact or before you make an argument, you should ask yourself three questions. Is what I'm about to say true? Is it kind? And is it helpful? Has anybody ever heard that before? I think there's actually some precedent for that in the Bible. Later in Philippians chapter 4, verse 8, Paul says, "Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things." Again, we need to agree with each other on the things that matter. The gospel, the thing we're supposed to be standing on. But we also have to learn to show grace to each other in the things that don't matter as much. Standing united also means that we love each other. Jesus said in John 13:35, "By this all people will know you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." This one should go without saying, right? But it can also be one of the most difficult things for us to actually pull off. Just love each other. Be kind and respectful to each other. Want good things for each other. Any action that you take toward another Christian should be motivated by caring for them, by wanting what's best for them, even though sometimes that does mean confronting, challenging them, lovingly encouraging them. But I can pretty much guarantee that what it never means is belittling them, picking on them, berating them, talking about them behind their backs, those sorts of things. Standing united also means we have to be humble. As Paul puts it here, put other people's needs ahead of your own. This one it requires a lot of trust. If I'm focused on taking care of your needs, who's taking care of my needs? I have to trust that you're going to take care of my needs. Now, this doesn't make a lot of sense to us sometimes in America because we're supposed to help ourselves out. We're supposed to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, right? If you have a problem, you're supposed to solve it. But if you think about it, that strategy actually, or the strategy that Paul is talking about here, looking out for each other, it actually makes a lot more sense. if we're all only looking out for our own needs, how many people care about your needs at any given time? One, right? If you have some good friends or family, maybe two or three. But if we're all looking out for each other's needs, then any given problem any one of us faces, how many people are looking out for it? Dozens, hundreds, right? Together we can be a lot more effective than any one of us can be alone. Now these last two things, love and humility, they're a lot easier if we actually build relationships with each other outside of what happens on a Sunday morning. So my encouragement is, let's try that. Invite another family over for dinner some night. Join a small group. Get involved in a Bible study. Get involved in a ministry where you will be working alongside of other Christians, especially if you can do that on other days of the week as well, so that you have more time together, not just on Sundays. It's hard to love other people, and it's hard to put other people first if you don't really know them. So I think living in community requires some extra time outside of Sunday mornings. And speaking from experience, by the way, there's some really cool people in this room. Get to know some of them a little more. And so in short, standing united means being like Jesus. Obviously, those are some big shoes to fill, right? But maybe it would encourage you to know that Jesus fully believed you could do this. In fact, in John 14:12, Jesus said, "Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever believes in me will also do the works that I do, and greater works than these will he do, because I am going to the Father." It still blows my mind every time I read that verse. Jesus is God. He healed the sick. He did miracles. He raised from the dead. And he says that we're going to do greater things than he did. How is that even possible? Maybe it's because Jesus is just one man. Yes, he's God, but he's 100% human as well. During his time on earth, during his ministry, he was confined to one place at one time. Yes, he did some absolutely amazing things, but he could still only do so much, and he still only had so much time. But now look around. In this room alone, there's dozens of us. There are thousands and thousands, maybe millions of Christians worldwide, and we've had 2,000 years to do this. We might not be able to do the miracles that Jesus did. We might not be able to teach as powerfully as he did or have the knowledge that he had, but what we lack in power, we make up for in sheer numbers. If that is, we stand united. Now we have a spiritual enemy that knows full well the power that the church can have if we are united together, if we work together. And so his mission is to divide us. If he can get us to bicker and fight and gossip and all sorts of other things and not work together, then he knows it's going to keep us from doing those greater things that Jesus talked about. And a lot of times, I look around at the church at large, and I have to admit, Satan is doing a pretty good job. We have to get along. We have to stand united. We will thrive in Christ when we stand united. And that starts with the Christians in this room. But it goes beyond that too. We have to get along with Christians everywhere, right? We can't afford to look at other churches as the competition. We don't have time and energy to waste in criticizing or complaining about the way that other Christians do things. We have to learn to work together, to stand united with every Christian who stands in the same gospel that we stand in. Because only then are we going to thrive in our faith. And only then are we going to stand a chance at transforming this world into what Christ intends for it to be. Let's go ahead and pray together.